Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
And our guest today is Professor Stephen Vladek. Professor Vladek, or we'll call him Steve, is the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas School of Law. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
I feel justified in calling you by your first name because I'm so much older than you are. But those of us who are around on Twitter still, certainly that's a platform in which you're very active and certainly feel like has allowed us to get to know you a little bit, aside from some other things that are likely to come up during the podcast. But we sure appreciate you being with us.
Absolutely.
As what Judge Kazmarek calls a professor with a Twitter account, I feel like I have to keep up the tradition.
Well, I'm glad you're the one that brought that up and not me.
Yeah. Here on the Appellate Law Podcast, we also know you as Karen's husband.
I think that's the far more important appellation. I realize that I can never hope to be your best Vladek guest. So I really, you know, all I can do is try to be second fiddle.
Yeah, I'm glad we're going to get that out of the way early because inevitably folks who follow us will hear your name and make the connection. And of course, if they know you from Twitter, they already know Karen from Twitter. But yeah, she's a hard act to follow. I really don't envy you the position that you're in today, but you have different focuses. And so I don't expect that she's going to attempt to cover some of the things that we'll talk about today, but I think the reverse is also true, although there's a lot of overlap in what you all do that we'll, I'm sure, get into. So after that really long introduction that involved very little talking on your part, why don't we let you talk a little? And we like to have our guests kind of introduce themselves to our audience. And so if you wouldn't mind just kind of giving some of your background, where you come from and so forth.
Sure. So where I come from in the literal sense is New York, born in Manhattan, grew up there. I just finished my 18th year as a law professor, which is kind of a scary number when I think about it. When I graduated from law school in 2004, I was pretty sure I wanted to teach. And part of why I was pretty sure I wanted to teach was because there were already examples around me of folks who were teaching, but also staying active in litigation and other hot button topics. And so clerked for a year on the Ninth Circuit for Marsha Berzon, who I adore, and then was somehow able to twist the University of Miami into making me an entry-level teaching job offer in the fall of 2005. And the rest, as they say, is history. I did 2 years at Miami, 11, math is hard. Actually, no, I just got the math wrong. Nine at American University. See, math is hard. 9 at American University in Washington, D.C., and then this was my 7th at UT. So I love teaching. I love that I don't only teach. I love getting to do some cases on the side. I'd be remiss if I said, I love Karen. So add those things together, and that pretty much gets you most of me.
I think all the references to Karen can only help our ratings. we're going to talk about some fun stuff today that don't involve Karen, but of course, your wife, we really enjoyed having her on as a guest, and we might have to have her on again sometime because she was just so much fun. Okay, so the 2 years at Miami and then also then at American, was it the one clerkship at the Ninth Circuit? I thought maybe you were one of those two clerkships.
I'm a weird two clerkship type. I never tried to get a second clerkship, but I was already teaching in Miami when Judge Rosemary Barquette had 2 vacancies come up in her chambers at roughly the same time. So basically, it was just a very lucky circumstance where someone with prior federal appellate judicial clerkship experience who was in Miami and could spare 6 months finished out the term. So I claim, I guess, 1.5 clerkships, but the second one was very non-traditional.
Okay. What is it that led you into the law from the first place? I think you suggested you had some examples. What do you mean?
I grew up in a family of lawyers. My father's parents were both lawyers. My grandmother was Columbia Law class of 1947. My dad's siblings, both lawyers. He was the black sheep in his family. So it's not that weird in retrospect that this is where I ended up. But I went to college thinking I wanted to actually be a historian. And when I was in college, I actually had a professor who was jointly appointed in the history and law, jurisprudence, and social thought departments at Amherst College, who really opened my eyes to the interaction and the interrelationship between law and history. and law and politics and the relevance of how law responds to historical trauma, law, you know, tries to sort of react to historical trauma, things like war crimes trials, truth commissions, et cetera. So I actually went to law school thinking I wanted to be a prosecutor for the International Criminal Court, which was then in its nascent stages. And then, guys, 9/11 happened. I mean, September 11th was my second day of torts. And in retrospect, it's entirely obvious that my interest in law and historical trauma quickly had me focused on the United States post 9/11 policy landscape and legal landscape. But I was also really fortunate to have a couple professors in law school who from pretty early on were working on some of those post 9/11 cases, some of the early Guantanamo cases, Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber. And so I was able to get in on the ground floor of a lot of that litigation, which both got me a lot of really good experience and also some cool ideas for academic projects and just really whetted my appetite for finding ways of doing more of that and more of that sort of cross-fertilization going forward.
That's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about the whole concept of law and historical trauma, as you put it. I mean, you've got some great examples just that happened right there when you were just a fledgling law student. And I can see that your interest is, if you pull up your bio, the UT website, I can see that this national security interest and so forth is really reflected there in some of the things that you've done. And that's pretty far away from what I do on a daily basis. So I do find it really fascinating.
I guess, I mean, one of the things that I'm very backwards in that I sort of came to the law atypical direction, not from the ground up, but sort of from the top down, where the last thing I ever learned how to do was to file a complaint or any kind of trial practice. I argued in the Supreme Court before I argued a motion to dismiss, which I think is pretty atypical in the world of lawyers. But I was very lucky at various points in my career to be in the right place at the right time. If I had gone to law school a year earlier or a year later, I think that whole landscape looks a lot different. My best friend and now the dean at UT, Bobby Chesney, tells a story about how he went on the teaching market, the academic teaching market, in the fall of 2000 and had mixed luck, not a lot of offers, and one especially poignant exchange where a professor at an elite law school asked him how he was ever going to make a career out of, quote, this Tom Clancy stuff, unquote. And not surprisingly, when Bobby went back on the market in the fall of 2001, all of a sudden national security law is a very hot topic and law schools are scrambling to figure out what to do. So there's an insight there about the utility of being on the leading edge of a wave, but it's helped me to do a lot of things in my career that I think would have taken much, much more time and labor, right, if it weren't so sort of evanescent.
When you say national security law, what kind of things do you put under that umbrella?
I think the class has actually changed a heck of a lot in the last 10 or 15 years. So in the early 2000s, I think that class was typically a like war powers and foreign relations class. So if you look at like old editions of casebooks in the field, half of it would be about like Vietnam and the Civil War, and half of it would be about things that are sort of, I think of not even as national security, but like diplomatic relations, treaties, foreign investment, all that kind of stuff. And I think post 9/11, that has shifted radically so that national security is a much larger field now that includes the entire umbrella of counterterrorism, which bakes in a lot of surveillance. Cyber, I think, is now in many contexts a national security topic. I think in the last couple of years, domestic terrorism has become a huge part of any national security discussion. I mean, this is actually one of my co-author Steve Dykus would say, environmental change, climate change, that we have seen basically an explosion in how topics that we didn't used to think of as being about national security nevertheless have national security overtones and undertones. And guys, I mean, we just spent 3 years going through the legal responses to the COVID pandemic, which of course is also. So I'm a co-author on the Aspen Publishers Casebook for National Security Law. And it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
Which is a bit of a challenge, especially as we're actually starting to work on the next edition. So I think it really has progressed away from the classic military heavy version.
Tom Clancy.
Yeah, exactly.
The Tom Clancy stuff. Yeah.
Right. I mean, pick your TV show, but now it's a combination of any number of other plot lines.
It seems like immigration has also taken kind of a big part of that in the last 4 or 5 years, too.
I would even say, I mean, even before that, I mean, I think post 9/11, I mean, there was a very, very clear linkage between some of the Bush administration's counterterrorism policies and some and immigration reform. And so I think, I mean, it's weird to say that national security is everything because it's not, but I think we've gotten better about understanding how lots of different fields of law have at least at their margins national security implications. Just one really, really strange example, I mean, tariffs. Steel tariffs can have massive national security implications depending upon what we're doing with them. So it's an evolving field, which makes it really, really fun pedagogically to teach and really, really terrifying as a casebook author to keep up with. You know, there are days where I wish I was a legal historian or maybe I just taught torts.
Right. Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry. And there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. It seems like there's a link between sort of the world getting smaller through technology. You think about Cold War days. I mean, in national security, you thought about Russia, maybe the Middle East. And those were all places that way over there that most of us, you know, we might not ever come into contact with. But today, I mean, with globalization of the economy and just everything is seems like it's much closer than it used to be. And it seems like there might be a link there.
Oh, I think there's no question. And I think the trickier part, and I think we haven't even begun to really answer these questions, is whether the kinds of conventional arguments for a national security exceptionalism, right, actually have to be recalibrated in a world in which it's nothing is especially exceptional, right? In a world in which this is the world.
Yeah.
When the exception becomes the norm, it's hard to justify having rules for the exception anymore. And I think that's a conversation that we've been very slow to have, at least in part because I think we've spent a fair amount of the last 6 years having even more basic conversations about our legal system and our legal order. But those conversations are there, and I think they're lurking.
It seems like living in Texas in particular, the federalism dimension of that has become a huge conversation too.
Yep. And questions about how much residual authority states have to do their own immigration policy, right? How much can governors use state National Guard troops, especially when they're not federalized, in ways that may be inconsistent with federal policy? I really think, I mean, we are scratching the tip of the iceberg on what it's going to look like legally now that it's becoming de rigueur for states to basically be the principal, the most visible opponents of presidents, whether it's Texas today or California during the Trump administration or who knows what state tomorrow.
Well, that's certainly a fascinating area. So you immediately launched into when you began your teaching career, focusing on these sorts of issues.
Yeah, my career has taken a bit of a strange path. Yeah, national security and federal courts was really where I made my hay as a junior professor. It's common, I think, for law professors to talk about sort of the writing at the intersection of the fields that they teach and research in. And so for me, it was like the intersection and overlap of national security and federal courts. And then something weird happened, which is that as time went on, it's not that I got less interested in national security. It's that those conversations didn't seem to be moving in any meaningful way. Like we kept having the same conversations. And I started paying more and more attention to the Supreme Court and sort of separation of powers topics that were not specific to national security, military justice topics that were not specific to national security. I guess I sort of slowly moved away from being in the middle of the national security conversation and toward just a more general public law conversation, which is part of what led me to, I think, more to where I am today.
Tell us how you went from teaching at American after spending 9 years there to uprooting, moving to Texas.
My parents are lifelong New Yorkers. They're the kinds of New Yorkers who think upstate starts at 96th Street. Right? There's a famous Saul Steinberg New Yorker cover called View of the World from 9th Avenue, which like the way the cover is set up, like it's a quarter of the cover is 9th Avenue, 10th Avenue, and then 10th Avenue, the Hudson River is the next quarter. And then the Hudson River to like California is the next quarter. And then the Pacific Ocean and Japan and Asia is the last quarter. So when I told my parents, you know, hey, we're moving to Texas, they were like, a little surprised. But, you know, guys, I mean, we love Austin. I mean, we moved here in the summer of 2016. I had always loved UT. I actually had an entry-level interview with UT when I was a baby aspiring law professor. I'll never forget Larry Sager, who was for a while the dean and is still on the faculty, basically said to me in a very polite, friendly way, you know, come back in 5 or 10 years. So I did. And Karen and I mean, we were in DC thinking about starting a family and just the specter of moving to Austin and being part of such a cosmopolitan, thriving community at a flagship university was too tempting to pass up.
Tell us about your teaching load right now. I assume you're teaching like federal courts and those sort of related courses, but what's it like working with law students in 2023?
It is exhilarating and maybe sometimes exasperating. So my typical load is the big upper level federal courts class, one big first year course. So I usually teach either constitutional law or civil procedure to first semester 1Ls. And then a seminar, because I'm doing my bid for King and Country with those two big classes. So the seminar can be basically whatever I want. So like next fall, I think my seminar is about the election of 1864, because why not?
What is the election of 1864? You've got to tell us.
Yeah. Tell us the significance.
We have to have the seminar. So the election of 1864, this is Lincoln's re-election in the middle of the Civil War. It is the first and to this day only example in world history of a democracy holding a national election in the middle of a civil war. It is a remarkable story about democratic resilience. It's a remarkable story about country over party. Thousands and thousands and thousands of so-called war Democrats cross over to vote for Lincoln because we're terrified of what would happen if they voted for the Democratic nominee, General McClellan. Lincoln is convinced as late as August 27th that he's going to lose and is trying to actually make plans for what to do during the lame duck period between the election and the inauguration to save the Union, because as he writes, the president-elect will have been elected on such grounds as it will be impossible to save the Union thereafter. There are a lot of really cool intersecting law, politics, history, and just culture stories there. The election of 1864 is actually the first great absentee voting election, because that's how they got the soldiers to vote. And so there's Nevada statehood is rushed through, the first state admitted to the Union in violation of the size restrictions of the Northwest Ordinance is Nevada, because they wanted three more electoral votes for the Republicans. Chief Justice Taney dies on October 12th, like 3 weeks before the election. So there's a lot of fascinating law, politics, and culture swimming around that election. And this is just me being a nerd, but like, if you look at like the elections that have literature unto themselves, there's 1800, there's 1876, the disputed election and the end of Reconstruction. There's 1968, 2000, 2016, right? A few others. 1864 is not part of that canon, I think, because by the time of the election happened, it was not close. The sort of the spoiler alert, right? Sherman captures Atlanta in the first week of September, and Farragut captures Mobile, and that just totally breaks the momentum of the peace Democrats. And so it ends up not being an especially close election, because the battlefield developments in September and October changed the entire tide of the election. But those weren't foregone conclusions. And so I think this is sort of getting too far into the future, but I think this might be my next book. And I'm starting it out the way the book is coming out this week started, which is I'm testing some ideas on some students and seeing what they think.
I like it. Do you accept non-student auditors in any of these classes?
Sure.
Okay, good.
Sure.
I may have to make some road trips down to Austin.
I was thinking that maybe we could turn this into a CLE program. Can you boil it down to a 30-minute or 45-minute CLE presentation?
I mean, the time won't be an issue. The issue is the L in CLE, right?
Yeah.
But to go back to your question, though, I mean, I think students, like the law student of today, is a student who is equal parts more engaged and more on top of the world and more cynical than the students of 10 or 15 years ago. Not so long ago, I had a bit of a hard time getting through to students why some of the technical stuff we do in these classes matters. That's just not true anymore. It's actually now a different problem, which is trying to persuade students, especially I think these days progressive students, that law matters and that what they're learning in their constitutional law and their federal courts classes, the doctrines and the broader principles have value independent of the judges and justices who are applying them. And that's a challenge I think we're facing today as law professors that we really haven't faced for much of the last, insert however long period of time you want. I mean, going back certainly as long as I've been in this job.
Wow, it's interesting. We're going to come to the book before too much longer, but I wanted to check with you in a little more detail about what I sort of label as your side gigs. You're Professor Vladek, but you do a lot of other stuff. And of course, part of that is having your family with Karen. And like we've touched on, anybody who follows either or both of you on Twitter get a flavor of that. This is interesting because it touches on both your national security law emphasis and also your family, because you're a podcaster. I think anybody who follows you knows that, but are you still doing the national security law podcast? I noticed that you were doing that, or I guess Dean Chesney.
Yeah, we're still doing it. I mean, Bobby is just about the only person I know who's busier than I am. So the scheduling has become more complicated than it used to be. But yeah, no, we are, we've known each other, gosh, since I was in law school. And one of the things that I think we figured out very early on is that we disagree about a lot, but we really like disagreeing with each other. And we learn a lot from our disagreements. And so I think we're both, especially in this day and age, committed to the bit of modeling how people from different backgrounds and with different priors can have sometimes strongly divergent views about legal and policy questions of a whole lot of significance, and yet sort of disagree without being disagreeable. So I think even as the sort of the prompts for us, the subject matter dries up sometimes, which it does, like the value of us is not just what we're talking about, it's how we're talking about it.
That's a really important point. I mean, modeling for the new generation is great. Are you noticing that the new generation of law student, I've got one in college. He's not too far away from being of law school age, but I don't think, fortunately for him and me, that he's pursued law. But it seems like in that generation, there are issues with confrontation and communication, you know, face-to-face communication, that maybe they struggle with that a little bit more than folks of y'all's vintage and mine do. So I'm curious about the modeling part of that. What do you hope that it leads to, I guess, and how the law students interact with it?
I hope that it just suggests that, like, we shouldn't be shy about expressing disagreements with each other in public. That we can say, well, that's a really good argument, but have you considered these other things? As opposed to, I can't believe you just said that. Why aren't you account? That there's a way of actually doing this that doesn't require you to suppress your views, and it doesn't require you to censor yourself. It just requires you to allow for the possibility that yours are not the only views represented in the room. And some of that, guys, I think is really just about the style and the tenor of the discourse and not its substance. And that's what I try to model in my classrooms. It's what Bobby and I try to model in the podcast. And I think it's missing from too much of what's happening. Certainly isn't happening on Twitter. I think that's the challenge that we find ourselves in right at this particular moment.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Well, you have another podcast that you do with the preeminent Vladik, Karen. So you want to tell us a little bit about that and how that got going?
Yeah, this one's actually, I think, more closer to dormancy, but it hasn't quite died. So Karen and I have a mutual friend who was so, I think, enamored of the sort of the banter and repartee that Karen and I have on Twitter and elsewhere that she thought it would be fun if we actually bottled it up. And so we started this podcast called In Loco Parents. I mean, it's In Loco Parentis with a second I.
Yeah.
First I, whatever, I. And the idea was to sort of combine, you know, just sort of talk about like the adventures of parenting and lawyering in that order. Not because we're experts at either, but just because there are a lot of lawyers out there who are also parents of young kids. And
yeah,
what we discovered pretty early on is that a lot of the problems we were having, the challenges we were experiencing, the sort of the pitfalls were common to lots of folks. And there's strength in numbers. There's value in figuring out like which things did you really screw up and which things are actually kind of endemic to the entire experience of parenting young kids, especially parenting young kids with two working parents. And so I think we both gained a lot from that. The downside is that as we've both gotten busier professionally, there's been less time for it, which is part of why I think there have been fewer episodes lately.
Well, it's still available to listen to and alive. And
it's great.
I think it's a different approach to things, but I think it's one of those things that helps, I think, to remind people that, hey, busy lawyers do have lives. They have children. They face the same problems that everybody else face. And I think it's a nice element, and especially when it's been discussed on Twitter. It has been a while, but do your students ever come up and ask you about it?
Yeah. The students, some because they're genuinely interested, some because maybe they think they'll get an edge from listening to some of my students are parents. And so I think it took some getting used to that, like, my students have access to a lot of my life and thinking and day to day that they're not experiencing directly through me. But you get used to it. And I think actually, I'm a big believer that part of being an effective teacher is letting the students in and is letting them see who you are. And if they develop some better ability of seeing who I am from other media, say, Lavi.
I want to, continuing with this theme of your side gigs, you mentioned advocacy work, being able to go and argue cases and at the highest levels. So how has that worked out for you, and how do you fit that into your schedule?
It's a bit random. I don't really go out looking for cases. Some of them just sort of find me in weird and quixotic ways. But yeah, I've argued 3 cases now in the U.S. Supreme Court. One of these days, maybe I'll win one. 2 cases in the Texas Supreme Court where I'm 50-50. It's really, really obviously energizing. You guys know this. Appellate arguments are a whole universe unto themselves. Mm-hmm. It's a great way of actually sort of, you know, synergizing my academic work with things that matter in the real world. It's a way of staying current and having a sense that, like, you're involved in the relevant conversations in the fields you're teaching. And it's fun. The first time I ever argued in the Supreme Court, one of the best pieces of advice I got was from one of my colleagues at UT, who reminded me that my job is to stand up in front of a room of people and persuade them that I'm right about something. My pug, by the way, has now marched into the background of the shot.
I just noticed.
Yeah, we just saw that.
Not the first time we've had a pet on the podcast, by the way.
Well, it won't be the last either. I think that, like, the practice for me is really a cool way of just staying abreast of what's going on in the universe and staying connected to the things that I'm writing about and teaching about.
Do you do much amicus work on top of that?
Yeah, I mean, less these days. When earlier in my career, I did a lot more amicus work, and it was a great way of building relationships. There's nothing quite like showing up and offering an amicus brief. There's nothing quite like showing up and offering an amicus brief for free to a party that is very happy to have it. Mm-hmm. Amicus briefs are one of those things that, as you get further in your career and as the time demands pick up, are sort of harder to justify. I think my practice has shifted. The amicus party litigation ratio used to be 100-0. Mm-hmm. And I think it shifted mostly to like 80-20 in the other direction.
Yeah. I have to imagine that being able to go in and do that advocacy work, you're teaching federal courts, keeping your finger on the pulse of what's actually going on in the court system and how the courts are approaching things, aside from just reading decisions, opinions, which you can clearly do, but going in and actually showing up and standing at the lectern, I think that has to be a pretty cool experience for you.
Yeah, I loved it. I'd love to do more of it. But also, I think it's the only sort of, I mean, other than the takes a lot of time, the sticky part is just remembering that you're an academic first. Todd, you call them side gigs and they're all side gigs, right? Remember what your real job is.
Well, I'm glad you find that my description is accurate, because I kind of assumed that was accurate, that side gigs would be really true. But it's impressive what you managed to maintain, because I think it's very difficult. It's certainly difficult as a lawyer to maintain side gigs because you have full-time responsibilities. But I do think, let's go ahead and move into what I'll say is maybe the last side gig we'll talk about today. You know, in addition to podcasting about national security, law, and raising kids, and your advocacy work, now you're a book author. I mean, you've published other things elsewhere, but now you've actually gone out and taken the time to write a book that's actually, by the time this episode airs, will be available for purchase. So tell us about the book, because it directly relates to the subject of our podcast. So we're excited to have you talk about it.
Sure. I don't want to sort of go too far into the weeds, because especially this audience will get the basic gist, but so the book is basically about what Will Bode dubbed the Supreme Court shadow docket. And that term means different things in different courts. It was used even before Will coined it for the U.S. Supreme Court to refer to some of what the Texas Supreme Court does. There's a version of it in the California state courts that I had never heard of until recently. Whatever. It's all getting at the same thing, which is that the U.S. Supreme Court does a heck of a lot of stuff every year that's really important, other than the 60-ish merits decisions the court hands down come April, May, and June. And Will's insight, which the book really tries to pick up on, is that it's not just that a lot of really important stuff happens through the rest of the court's docket, through unsigned, unexplained orders, whether granting or denying certiorari or granting or denying applications for emergency relief. It's also that, like, there are respects in which you will get a better picture of the institution as a whole if you account for all of what it's doing. So I think there are relationships between the justices that are more visible on the shadow docket. There are voting patterns that I think are more visible on the shadow docket. There's a broader sort of shift in the relationship between the court and, for example, Congress that I think is more visible on the shadow docket. Mm-hmm. And so what I set out to do is I set out to write a book that basically did two things. The first was just to introduce readers to this side of the court's work, right? To educate and to basically say like, hey, when you think about the Supreme Court, you should also be thinking about certiorari. You should also be thinking about emergency applications. You should also be thinking about like these other things that may look procedural, but can often have massive substantive effects. Mm-hmm. And then second, and this is where I think the book gets into a little bit more divided territory, is to use the historical baseline the book builds and the sort of the framework the book creates to try to point out the ways in which the court over the last 6 years has broken from traditions, right? Has acted in ways that are inconsistent with prior courts and in ways that the book tries to argue are actually deeply problematic. I don't expect I'm going to persuade everyone about the problematic nature of the court's behavior, mm-hmm. but I will be very, very happy if the book persuades readers, one, that this is something we ought to talk about, and two, that the recent behavior is different. Those two things by themselves would make me a very happy camper.
How much had the concept of the shadow docket really been talked about in legal academia before you started talking about it?
I mean, Will was it. So Will Bode wrote an article in 2015 in the NYU Journal of Law and Liberty, where he coined the term, and he used it to talk, at least in that article, specifically about summary reversals, mm-hmm. which is where the Supreme Court at the certiorari stage decides a case, usually in an unsigned opinion, usually without a second round of merits briefing or hearing from a lot of friends of the court. And Todd, I guess the first 3 or 4 years after Will's article, there's no additional scholarship that picks up the idea of the shadow docket as such. There are people looking at individual slices of it, but the idea of studying it as a thing, I think I probably am the second person who really sort of jumped into that space. And part of that was I was invited by the Harvard Law Review to write for the annual Supreme Court issue at the end of the October 2018 term, so the one that came out in the fall of 2019. And they wanted me to write about the Solicitor General, and I wanted to write about the shadow docket. So naturally, the title of the piece is The Solicitor General and the Shadow Docket.
Well done.
Law professors, man, we're so creative. One of the remarkable things I said earlier that like I've been very lucky in my career to be at the right place in the right time. This is another case of that. I mean, I started working on the shadow docket at what was probably, in retrospect, the upslope of the remarkable shift in how the court uses it. So that there I am on Twitter with like Excel spreadsheets documenting all of the applications, right? Mm-hmm. And I was able to see in sort of live time how the court's behavior was changing. And then the task just became building the historical narrative and the developing the yardstick against which to measure what the current court was doing.
I don't want to spoil any parts of your book, but kind of how did courts like the Warren Court, the Burger Court, the Rehnquist Court, how did they use it or did they use it traditionally?
The court has always, Jody, had some mechanism for dealing with emergencies. I mean, appellate courts have to.
Sure.
But the model that persists throughout the 20th century, or at least until 1980, is a very sort of circuit justice driven model where emergency applications were handled by the individual justice with geographic responsibility for that part of the country. And that model was not perfect. It could lead to some awkward moments if circuit justices disagreed with each other, which happened especially when Justice Douglas was one of them. But it had a couple virtues, right? So circuit justices were more nimble, meaning it was easier for a single justice to hold literally in chambers oral arguments, right? It was more common for justices to write in chambers opinions where they're literally just writing by themselves. And so you had more process, and Jody, you had like less of a sort of risk that this temporary interim order would be mistaken for some broad pronouncement from the full court. Mm-hmm. And that was the pre-1980 model that I think had a lot going for it. The post-1980 model is what we're used to today, which is where any remotely divisive application gets referred to the full court, where the norm is to not have argument. There's been one set of arguments on emergency applications since the 1970s, where the norm is not to write anything. And so you have both less process and less transparency and a much greater risk of the decisions being viewed as full court pronouncements on substance. And I think that shift, which happened in the 1980s in the death penalty context, I think is a big part of the story, because it's only really in the Trump administration that we see the court export the problematic changes in behavior that had to that point really been confined to the Capitol context into the context of nationwide injunctions against immigration policies, statewide COVID restrictions, elections, abortion, mifepristone, I mean, you name it.
You've mentioned capital punishment. I mean, what brought about the change in the 80s to the different sort of style of doing it?
The court did, right? I mean, because the court, as I talked about in chapter three, like the court, when it brought back capital punishment in 1976, after the court had frozen capital punishment in 1972, it brought it back with a whole bunch of new legal obstacles and a whole bunch of new sort of claims that death row prisoners could bring, but oftentimes not until an execution date had been set. And so it's actually a sort of unintentional result of how the Supreme Court judicializes the death penalty that leads to an explosion in emergency applications en masse, and then pushes the court to change how it deals with them, right? Pushes the court, because everyone understood that the court was deeply divided about the death penalty. And so the court's sort of knee-jerk reaction was that the old circuit justice model would not hold up against the onslaught of new death penalty applications. And I guess in retrospect, I'm not sure that that was right, but it is profoundly responsible for where we are today.
So I have this vision of you sitting in your home office with Excel open, just entering all kinds of data to try and get at the trends. And I can only imagine to be able to distill that kind of information together, it had to be a tremendous amount of work. You were going back over a really long period of time, as you just described, just to be able to really cull out trends and using the shadow docket. So how did you fit that into your already busy schedule?
I suffer from the curse that when I'm interested in something and excited about something, I tend to sort of work fast. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing because it means I can be quite productive. It's a bad thing because it means when I'm working on something I'm not excited about, it gets in the way. I mean, this is one of the wonderful things about my real job, is that taking time to actually do research and to build that kind of record is not a frolic. It's actually like what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I was going to say it's expected.
Right. I've been lucky to have a cadre of great research assistants and now two different sets of seminar students who helped with all of this. So their influence is all over the book.
It's hard to imagine one person being able to take this on by themselves. It would take years, I would imagine. And by the time you got it all together, the data would be out of date.
Herein lies the rub about writing a book about current events. I mean, I started the project on the upslope, and I'm desperately hoping that we're on the downslope, because the content of the book is basically locked as of last October. So any important thing that happened since last October is not in the book, which we'll see how that goes when folks are like, wait, where's the mifepristone case? Not there.
Right, right. Not there. Let's just pave the way for the second edition.
Oh, gosh. Let's get through the first edition first, Todd.
How is the court treating its sort of shadow docket orders in terms of precedential value?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the other things that's really shifted, Jody. So historically, the sort of the absolute clear mantra was that these orders didn't have any precedential effect because they're unexplained. And that's changed. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the context of the COVID cases, especially with regard to religious liberty challenges to state COVID mitigation measures, is that we actually saw the court now overtly invoking unexplained orders as precedents in at least two contexts. So first, the court uses unsigned unexplained orders as a basis for vacating and remanding decisions to lower courts and say, hey, we want you to reconsider what you did in light of this thing where we didn't explain anything. So-called GVR, a grant, vacate, and remand. But also, there's actually a remarkable order called Gateway City Church, where the court actually chastises the Ninth Circuit and says, the decision in this case was clearly dictated by our prior ruling in case with no opinion. And so I think there was a part of the story here is that things got kind of out of hand. Probably in late 2020 and early 2021. I actually think we're now recovering from that a bit. I think the court has tweaked its behavior and at least moderated some of the excesses of the last couple of years. But part of that story, too, is about a response to public pressure and about sort of how much the shadow docket became a source of public discussion and criticism of the court, especially after the SB 8 ruling in September 2021. So just to sort of tie all the threads together, I mean, my principal goal in writing the book was not to persuade folks that my critiques are correct, but rather to persuade them that, like, we ought to at least talk about the shadow docket as a significant part of what the court does. Mm-hmm. And we ought to understand all of the ways in which the Supreme Court affects all of our lives on a daily basis, not just we, the appellate lawyers, but we, the non-appellate lawyers of America, in ways that I think might change how we talk about reforming the court, might change how we talk about accountability for the court. I mean, just you name it. And I think it's a different conversation if we actually are looking at the full picture and not just seeing the court as the sum of its decisions in Dobbs and Bruin in those cases.
From a practical perspective, what does the court have in front of it when it's looking at these issues? It doesn't have the full record, I would presume, and probably very limited briefing.
Yep. No, I mean, it's very limited briefing. Maybe it has a preliminary injunction record that maybe the district court was able to build in granting or denying a preliminary injunction. But even there, Jody, I mean, we've seen the court do stuff that's, you know, flatly inconsistent with the record. It's not an ideal way. Like, it is no way to be doing deep principled decision making. That's not what emergency applications are for. And I think the quicker that the court goes back to that understanding, I think the better for everybody.
Well, I don't think we've actually said the name of the book, although it's clearly about the shadow docket. But the name of the book is The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. As we said, the book is, by the time this episode airs, it's going to be out. Where will our listeners be able to find it? Pretty much anywhere?
Hopefully. That'll be a test. Can you find it in your local bookstore? So it's on Amazon, it's on Barnes & Noble, it's on your favorite local indie site. For folks who are in Austin, if that's a significant part of the listener base, we're doing an event at Book People, Evan Smith and me, on May 25th. So wherever your books are sold and wherever your podcasts are recorded.
We're going to wrap up here in just one second, but you're going on a little mini book tour, I think, aren't you?
A mini tour. Believe it or not, the publishers these days are much more into podcasts than they are into bookstores.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
On the theory that you can get more people listening to a podcast than you can into a room for a book talk.
Makes sense.
That explains, maybe aside from a little goading from Karen, why you agreed to come on the podcast. But we're happy to talk about, I mean, it's a fascinating issue.
It is.
We're happy to talk about it. I'm interested to learn more about it because I don't follow the U.S. Supreme Court nearly as closely as you do. So this is, it's really a fascinating issue for me to hear about. And I look forward to reading the book.
Thanks.
Same here.
Once it's available.
Well, you have to let me know what you think.
Yeah, we really appreciate this. It's kind of our tradition to close up each episode with a tip or a war story. Do you have something you'd like to share?
I'll do a war story, which is, so my very, very, very first oral argument in any court ever was my first Supreme Court argument in January 2018. And it was in this hyper-technical sort of military courts case that was known when it was granted as Dalmazzi, although it was known when it was decided as Ortiz. And if we had 45 minutes, I could tell you why the question was relevant, but I'm almost all the way through the topside argument. I haven't made a total fool out of myself. I haven't spilled anything. I haven't knocked over the microphone. I'm feeling good about having survived the gauntlet. And then Justice Kennedy gets this mirthful look on his face, and he leans in the microphone in all seriousness, and he asked me whether I thought Marbury versus Madison was rightly decided.
Softball question.
Well, and so here's the thing, right? So there was a way in which the question was not unrelevant to the case, because when you go to an oral argument, like, most of the people aren't all the way into the case the way that the advocates and the judges are.
Sure.
But, like, he wasn't asking about, like, does the Supreme Court have the power of judicial review? He was asking about the actual holding of Marbury, whether Congress can't expand the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. But there I am, like, my first argument is going great, and all of a sudden, Anthony Kennedy asked me if I think Marbury is rightly decided. So the courtroom bursts out into laughter, including the rest of the justices. Kennedy is the only person not laughing. He says, with respect to, and then he clarifies that he's asking me the real technical question. And so there I am on the fly, like, hey, is Marbury rightly decided? So I think if you go back and read the transcript, I said something to the effect of, I'm one of those federal court scholars. I shamelessly invoked my academic cred. I said, I'm one of those federal court scholars who thinks that Chief Justice Marshall read both the statute and the Constitution so he could reach the question he wanted to reach, right?
Ooh.
That said, comma, I'm not sure he was wrong. Before Kennedy could say another word, I said, and if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Oh.
So all that's a long way of saying that when you're prepping for your very first argument ever, never fully give up on the possibility that someone's going to ask you if Marbury was rightly decided.
Well, that's a perfect place to end our discussion today. Steve, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it. And again,
thank you guys for having me.
Look forward to reading the book.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.